What's up, man? How you doing?
Good. How about you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. You had a good day so far?
It's been good. It's been a eventful couple of weeks, but breathing and all is well.
Good. I'm glad to hear it, man. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah.
Oh, I went rock climbing for a few hours today, so my body's pretty much dead, but I really only need my brain to work for this situation, so we should be okay.
Well, my brain's pretty much dead, but we'll see how it goes.
Hey, have you been on the Joe Rogan podcast yet?
No.
Oh, dude, you should totally do that. You know, he's fascinated by DMT. I reckon he'd love to speak with you.
Know. He's a tough egg to crack. We've been trying to just solicit some funds for research because it's just really hard to fund this stuff.
Yeah, of course.
And he's definitely high on that list. So
Yeah,
yeah,
man.
we have a couple people that are pretty tight with him. So I'm actually supposed to talk to Dennis McKenna next week about maybe trying to set something up. So
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, that'd be great, man. I mean, it's all good exposure, right?
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You're a musician as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I would like to think so still. I kind of just, don't really know, like with most things, I don't really know what I'm doing, and I just kind of plug a bunch of things together and see what happens.
Yeah,
So
I can relate to that, dude. I can relate. But you're a guitarist, right? I'm same here, by
yeah,
the way.
nice.
Yeah. So something that I've loved for a long time. And are you an acoustic or an electric kind of guy?
Both, but I would say more electric. I like I was saying, I like to mess around with effects pedals and try to make the guitar sound as not guitar-like as possible.
Nice, man. Nice.
Kind of my bag.
So I wanted to get you on for a discussion because I've noticed what appears to be a rise of interest in psychoactive research within the Western arenas of medicine and neuroscience and pharmacology over the past few years. And I think that this could be the introductory phases of a transition in how we view and utilize psychoactive compounds and how they impact our state of consciousness. And this is especially true, I believe, for dimethyltryptamine or DMT, which is not only the most potent, as psychedelic substance known to man, but is also endogenous to human biochemistry. And so, as someone who's devoted their time to this subject, would you agree that we might be on the edge of a revolution in science?
Yeah, I don't generally use terms like revolution, but I don't know. I mean,
That's just me being a shameless optimist.
no, it's not. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's clearly a fascinating question. So I guess in terms of how we sort of have come to know how neurotransmission works, just in general, a lot of that was founded in psychedelics, the realization that serotonin and LSD are similar, and then sort of uncovering that that's the reason LSD has the impact that it does on the brain. But it would not be the reason, but that's the pharmacology that underlies everything else that happens. So that's just all kind of went overlooked, in my opinion, with the idea that the DMT is also been found in mammalian bodily fluids, et cetera. And so there's a lot of, it's weird because like a lot of non-science individuals will just sort of accept the fact or assume if they're interested in like mysticism, new age stuff, that DMT is a neurotransmitter, which from the scientific perspective, we don't really have that locked down 100%. So we don't know per se if that's the case.
Right.
But where we've been working is trying to just follow that line of logic that has established things like serotonin, dopamine, acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter. And step one was kind of the paper that we published in 2019 because it looked in the brain for the first time of a living animal. And it quantified not only DMT levels, but also the enzymes or the genes that have been shown to be capable of biosynthesizing DMT. And we found DMT and the genes, as you probably know, in the same brain area, and the genes, the co-expression of the mRNA in the same neurons in the rat visual cortex, which is crazy because we all know that DMT is a very visual compound. So then the next question was, well, are these levels really pertinent to physiology? Yeah, and so we were pretty blown away when we just quantified what we were looking at and compared it to serotonin, because it was in our hands half of serotonin, which is I mean, there's differences in obviously pharmacology, right? Just because something's there at a level half of something doesn't mean it activates a certain receptor the same way. So it still may not be enough. But yeah, I mean, I think that from what I've personally seen with my own hands and my own eyes researching it, it certainly warrants more of a follow-up and more people looking into the question of, is it a neurotransmitter? And if so, like, what is it doing, right? Is it involved in mood? Is it involved in how vision works? Is it have any ties to mental health like serotonin? If there's alterations in the system, is it involved in the psychedelic response, much like endogenous opioids and endogenous cannabinoids are involved in when you take an opioid or you take well, the systems anyways, the neurotransmitters or the pharmacological systems. When you smoke cannabis, you know, it all interacts. So maybe when you take a psychedelic, it's interacting with the endogenous compounds that are known to be psychedelic in high enough levels. So yeah, I know it's a long-winded response, but I think that it's a question worthy of further follow-up. And I keep saying in my hands because people have pointed out, you know, every now and then read some of the comments on the paper or the YouTube videos or whatever, and people do point out, well, that's just one study, and it's true, it's just one study, so it does need to be replicated over and over before it really locks itself in as, hey, we got a grasp on this.
Yeah, absolutely. But we really are, even though these things have been in circulation for a long time because of the legal status of researching these things, we really are at the beginning of dipping our toes into this kind of research, right?
Yeah, I would say. For sure, especially the endogenous stuff. I mean, it's been known and it's been looked at for many decades, but not quite with the same level of rigor as, well, not even rigor, because the people that are looking at it are rigorous, but it just hasn't been looked at as much. Like there aren't multiple groups looking at endogenous DMT, like there are multiple groups that have studied serotonin and dopamine. So hopefully that happens at some point. And yeah, and then yeah, you do the science, and you know, you get an answer that's you know, even if it's not your hypothesis, it's valid. So if DMT doesn't do anything in the brain, then great. We've at least I find that hard to believe that that would be the case, like that the brain would just manufacture something half of serotonin for a good chuckle. But you know, I'm open to that possibility.
Well, yeah, because I mean, I was made aware of your paper on DMT from a documentary called DMT Quest, and for everyone listening, there'll be a link in the description box for it, and I'd encourage you all to check it out. Very well made documentary, and it features an interview of yourself and highlighted your research paper. Now, I'm not a scientist. I'm just a layman who's interested in these types of issues. But I would love to talk about this paper a little bit, what it represents. As you said, it seems to be suggesting, amongst other things, that DMT could be present within our own biochemistry at levels comparable to serotonin, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the study was in rats, right? And it doesn't necessarily scale up, but
Well, that was something I wanted to ask you, because I know that we use rats for a lot of different types of reasons, but is there a potential, because of the fact that you've discovered this within rats, that it can translate to humans, or what kind of work has to be done to find that step into the human biochemistry?
yeah, I mean, rats are a pretty reliable model for humans. And that, from my knowledge, it generally does scale up. You know, if you're looking, so things that we know more about, like serotonin in rats and humans, it appears it's synthesized in the same brain area, and it also sort of has the same neurochemical physiology. So it generally scales up, I think. But to translate that, yeah, it's a long way off, because so little is known in terms of how to translate that to a human brain. But some of the techniques that have been used before, like PET, et cetera, just knowing basic things like, if DMT is endogenous and it is serving some sort of physiological role, what receptors does it bind to, et cetera?
Well, if it, you know, just obviously in the realms of speculation, because as you said, we're not there yet with human studies. But if it turns out that DMT is comparable in concentrations to a fundamental hormone like serotonin, I mean, what do you think this means? Because in my mind, if the most potent psychedelic known to man turns out to be not a trace amount inconsequential to functions chemical, but is instead considered to be a fundamental biochemical, if it turns out that's the case, I mean, that opens up some pretty interesting doors, right?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, just to speculate a little bit, I'm interested most in the idea of just sort of starting with things that are a little more mundane. So to me, the first question would be, especially since we found it in the visual cortex, is it playing some role in vision? That's because the molecule is so inherently a visual subjective experience. And maybe alterations when you take a huge dose of it are the reason that your visual system sort of warps and changes in the way that it does. So I think that's like a fundamental type of question, like what is it doing in everyday physiology? And some of the work that's coming out showing that psychedelics have neuroplastic effects. And there was a recent study, I don't think it was published, it was one of the pharm companies, but they actually applied an nanomolar level of DMT and found that effect, which is the levels that we were seeing. We saw it in like low nanomolar levels in the brain. And so they did that study using those types of levels and found it to be this like neuroplastogen. So yeah, maybe it's involved in just protecting neurons, and that would be reasonable. In our study, it was the cardiac arrest induced increase in DMT. So it could be one role is as a neuroprotectant.
And then a side effect of that is a spiritual awakening for some reason.
Maybe, right? Yeah, the question of whether the levels that we see, what we saw in the cardiac arrest are in the ballpark of what would sort of activate 5-HT2A. It's a little lower, I think, but it just needs to be repeated, the study. So we didn't have the best like temporal resolution. We were sampling like every 15 minutes at the best. So minute by minute sampling in that study, you might find levels that are different, you know, could be higher or not. But, and then other things like the probe that, so the in that study, the probe is actually like in the living rat brain tissue and it's sampling continuously. And the probe definitely doesn't sample the whole amount. It's usually about like 7 to 10% recovery. So what we were seeing potentially could be like much higher. But again, like who knows? But yeah, right. Interesting side effect, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be honest, it is, and I think that's going to be something. Yeah, side effect. I think that's going to be something that really confronts rational medicinal science if they're really going to dive into psychoactive research. Is, you know, yeah, you can talk about receptor security and it being a protector of certain things in the body, but why is it that so many people have these experiences that can, I mean, obviously there's the neural plasticity effect and change in behavioral patterns that have been put over time through trauma and things like that. So there is a neurological effect taking place, but there's a commonality amongst experiences within things like ayahuasca and DMT of you know, entities, intelligent entities of some form that seem to have some level of linguistic capability to convey knowledge, to convey realizations. And I think that Western science is too quick sometimes to throw things like that to the side and discard it as noise in the brain or working out complex issues in the brain. But where do you personally sit on that side of this issue, the fact that there are these very what people could call spiritual experiences from this?
So I guess I'll comment on the whole spectrum of the things you said. That's sort of the scientific way, though, to try to find the most rational answer. And that's historically what has led science forward. So science trying to tackle like mysticism, etc. I mean, that's certainly the wavelength that I'm on. I mean, I'm more than open to the idea that when you have a spontaneous religious experience or mystical experience, which millions of people have had, there's going to be some sort of physical thing in the brain that happens that is different, right? I mean, if just sort of like watching television or playing tennis or thinking of playing tennis or whatever, there's all these different paradigms that they use in an MRI scanner that you can just completely change how the brain is. The blood flow in the brain changes. So if you have a spontaneous religious experience, I would imagine things are going to change. And to have the hypothesis that some of these endogenous compounds that are known to have psychedelic effects in large doses may be involved like DMT, I think it's completely rational. I don't think it's everything because the brain's super complicated, right? And even spiking serotonin like with like MDMA or something, right, is going to and that's how drugs like psilocybin work too, is by increasing serotonin a lot. So there's going to be a lot more to it than just one magical compound, I think, or one magical receptor. So I don't subscribe to any of those notions, but I am completely open to that idea that the science should have a place at the intersection of mysticism and trying to explain some of these things from the physical domain. Will it ever be able to tackle the metaphysical? Probably not. But I don't think that should be the point. I think the point should be to know where the limitations of science are, respect those limitations, and work with people that are on the other side of the conversation instead of writing off an indigenous culture that has used these compounds for these medicines for centuries. There's a lot of knowledge that's inherent in that, right? Knowing the psychological headspace is the other half of the story of knowing like how the brain changes. So, and linking those two things together, although incredibly difficult, I think is a worthy endeavor.
I agree with you completely. Is the pineal gland responsible for the synthesis and secretion of DMT in the brain, or is that just a kind of unconfirmed rumor?
Well, so the pineal gland had, without a doubt, the highest concentration of the mRNA expression for both of the DMT enzymes, or the enzymes that are known to biosynthesize DMT, to be capable of it. So in that study, that's what we did. We had the probe was such that in the rat brain, it was like where my nose is, right, is the pineal gland, and where my cheeks are is the visual cortex.
Right.
And so it was sampling from both, like going through the pineal gland. And that gave us the ability to remove the pineal gland and still sample from only the visual cortex. I have this very skilled surgeon in the lab that did that. And what we found is that we still saw DMT even after taking the pineal gland out. So even though the enzymatic concentration was enormous in there, but the pineal gland is known to make all these other compounds that are so in line with the DMT biosynthetic pathway, like melatonin, serotonin. So it's not surprising that you would see those enzymes, which also factor into that. Well, the AADC enzyme, but the INMT enzyme, which is pretty specific to DMT, was also very robustly expressed. But removing it, the conclusion is that since we saw DMT after we took the pineal gland out, that at the very least the pineal gland is not necessary for DMT biosynthesis in a rat. But interestingly, we did see almost a twofold increase in DMT when we took the pine needle out. So
Oh wow, okay.
whether or not it was like P equals 0.05, so it was not significant, but you know, it's like, I mean, interesting, right? We don't know if that was just some sort of compensatory mechanism that, that when you remove something that is making a lot of DMT, then other areas overcompensate to make more, or
Right,
who
right,
knows?
right. Have you got any speculation on what those other areas might be in terms of specific organs or parts of the body that synthesize DMT?
Yeah, we did do a lot of co-labeling with the mRNA. So we looked in the brain, and then we also looked, we looked in the visual cortex, we looked in the hippocampus, we looked in the choroid plexus. Well, we looked through the whole brain, but where we saw that co-expression mostly was, we saw it in the frontal cortex a little bit too, but it was in the visual cortex a lot, the dual expression of the DMT biosynthetic genes. And that's where the probe was, so that's kind of where we focused the most. And then in the pineal gland, we saw a ton of expression. We saw pretty good expression in the hippocampus and also in the choroid plexus, which is the site of cerebrospinal fluid production.
Right, right.
And then we also looked in peripheral tissues. And that was a really interesting part of the study, because the lungs have for many, many years been thought to be a really probable site of DMT synthesis, because the enzyme that has been shown, like in vitro, like in the dish, you know, you purify the protein, and then you could throw the precursors to DMT, like radio labeled, into just like a dish, essentially a tube, and then you can sort of look at the outcome of like radio labeled tryptamine. Then you look for radio labeled DMT after you put it in there, and they remove, in the original studies, they removed that enzyme and purified it from lung. And then newer studies have shown there's a lot of that enzyme in the lungs. So we looked in the lungs, but we also looked for AADC, which is the other enzyme that takes tryptophan to tryptamine. And with the idea being that if both of those enzymes are present, the likelihood of DMT synthesis is much higher. And we saw that in the brain. But when we looked in the lung, we didn't see a whole lot of AADC expression. And we also looked in a couple other organs too. We looked in like kidney and liver. And we saw kind of the same thing in the kidneys, that it was like a very segregated expression. So like the cortex versus the medulla were broken apart. So one was really hot for AADC and one was really hot for INMT, but not together. So, and then the adrenal gland too, actually. So we did see some co-expression in the adrenal gland of the INMT and the AADC. So possible the adrenal gland could biosynthesize DMT.
So
a lot of work to
yeah.
be done. We didn't have, unfortunately, we didn't probe all those areas for DMT, but only the visual cortex.
Well, it's interesting that it's kind of peppered around all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, so INMT, admittedly, it does a lot. It's a methylation enzyme, and it's pretty important to have those in the body. It serves a lot of different functions. Yeah, so just because they're there doesn't mean that that's what's happening. But in the visual cortex, at the very least, we can say, well, we see DMT there and we see those two enzymes there, so they're likely working together to make DMT there.
You know, to me, DMT and other psychoactive compounds provide, to be honest, a pretty distinct challenge to modern science, especially when placed under the scrutinizing lens of rationalism and materialism, reductionist science, because to me, and you know, I'm kind of half analytical and half spiritual. So I've got this side to me where I'm like, you know, there really seems to be a profound mystery to reality, and I'm amazed by consciousness and I want to know what that's about. But I'm also very much, you know, interested in the data and compounding actual information about our reality. So I'm always teetering between the two things. But the resurgence of interest in psychoactive research to me is probably going to force the rational scientific mind to engage with these realms of the abstract and the kind of transcendental, dare I even say, the realms of the spiritual, because there's no getting around the fact that chemicals like DMT can and usually do, like we were talking about before, elicit a sense of spiritual or moral revelation for the user. So do you think that we could be approaching a time where rational materialist perspectives in science are going to maybe be put under a bit of pressure to change their models and outlooks because of the results of studying psychedelics and especially endogenous biochemical psychedelics?
Oh, it's a great question. I mean,
Sorry, I know your brain's tired. I'm probably frying you out here.
no, it's all good. It's all good. No, I'm always happy to talk about this stuff with people. So I guess from my vantage point, I don't see it as, like I said earlier, as something that should really be at odds. I just think it's a sort of comes down to the idea of knowing like what one discipline can and cannot contribute, and knowing the blind spot or the limitations. You can still, in my mind, in my opinion, design an incredibly rigorous classical scientific experiment to contribute to the conversation of mysticism. And there is that line though of like where it really starts to get blurred, right? And I think we are starting to see that big time. But I think thankfully the groups that are sort of leading that, and even our group to some extent, because we look at things like meditation, et cetera, they are open to those possibilities, but they are conducting rigorous science. And one that really comes to mind is like the work that Chris Timmerman's been doing with DMT. Because he really focuses on like phenomenology, but also, you know, they're doing EEG and MRI and trying to get at like how does that subjective experience map to what changes in the brain. So I think rather than just say, oh, okay, you know, the brain change, most of the big groups are trying to put the subjective experience to the brain changes to kind of get a better understanding of. Well, what the hell is meeting, you know, some rational, like what seems to be freestanding entity that communicates with you telepathically? You know, okay, so maybe it's a phantom of our brain, right? Because we see entities everywhere, and in an inebriated state, everything just gets really stripped down. And say DMT does play some role in visual processing. Everything just gets stripped down to this sort of strange way that your brain has never processed it before. And your brain likes to make sense out of shit, right? It fills in the blanks. That's what it does. It's a prediction machine. So when it sees that, it just goes, oh, entity. Telepathic communication. So maybe I'm like wandering off a little bit, but point being is groups like Imperial and Timmerman and Hopkins, et cetera, they are being open to that. So I think that it is going forward with a more open mind as of recent.
Well, I think that's important, and it's also important to look at that aspect, not to throw it away, but like you said, to look at it as what could be causing these types of experiences to happen within people when they have these types of psychedelic experiences. Why does that occur? And if there is a rational neurological function explanation for it, fantastic. If not, kind of even more fantastic, because that provides a real mystery as to what the hell is going on when you can just fly out into hyperspace on endogenous biochemicals. So I think that's a really interesting aspect of it that I think is going to challenge modern science a little when they study these compounds. But do you think that there's a potential, speaking more about kind of psychedelic reintegration into society, if these things become accepted in medicine, and there's likely a trickle-down effect into pharmacology, and they become utilized by humans more often, and perhaps there's a you know a, the legal status might change for these things like it's changed for cannabis in America and in Canada. if there was going to be some sort of reintegration of psychedelics into society, do you think that that could actually have a knock-on effect for society in terms of behavioral changes? You know, if we're looking at the impacts psychedelics have on mental health and neural plasticity, increased empathy, increased sense of connectivity, is there a chance that we could actually create a bit of a social shift if these things are reintegrated?
Well, I hope so. I mean, they were certainly a part of the original counterculture movement.
Right.
But I think right now they're becoming more bipartisan, which is good. And it's becoming more of, it's placing an emphasis again on mental health and on trying to figure out new ways to help people. Because, I mean, come on, we're all sick.
Okay. Oh yeah, brother. Oh yeah.
We're all living in Western society, which is sick. Mm-hmm. Okay. Not like sick.
No, we're talking about, like, the bad sick.
It needs help. You know, like 25 flavors of Campbell's chunky soup is not the best we can do.
No.
So I think that hopefully, I mean, one of the things that, so we're starting at UCSD very soon to start to give psilocybin to individuals with phantom limb pain, to amputees that have chronic phantom limb pain. But one of the, we have an Institute for Empathy and Compassion that is really just,
I like that,
an amazing place there. Yeah, that they're doing a ton of different research avenues, from neuroscience, like the social aspects, to education on empathy and compassion and cultivation of empathy and compassion. So one of the offshoots of what we'll be doing with the psilocybin is just a natural path to take is to, we've been working with that center to, cool, to also look at empathy and compassion changes following psilocybin. So, I mean, I hope so. I hope that that's part of it. And I hope that we get to a point where you don't just have to have some sort of diagnosis, where, you know, you are going to be able to just say, you know, I want to have an experience that changes how I feel about my life or about things that are negative in my life. And you can do so in a safe environment with people that are well-trained to get you through the other side and, you know, have your best interest in mind. And then, yeah, you can go try to work on some things that maybe aren't necessarily on your medical record, but.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, it's funny, you talked about the counterculture of the 1960s, and I think that now it's being looked at as, it's kind of absurd that these things are still illegal. I mean, not everyone will agree with that, but there's definitely, like you said, a shift in the bipartisanship of this issue, and it's being looked at under a scientific lens. I think with the 1960s counterculture, it was such a shock to the status quo at that point, and it was at such odds with the militaristic authoritarian style of the government at that time, that they were just like, we're going to stamp this out. And America did what it did best, and it waged a war on drugs. And so we have been kind of recovering from that after effect. But what I find interesting about now is that you can't really wage that war again. We've now seen that it was unnecessary, that it failed, that it, you know, was anti-science, that it was biased. And so when it comes up, and it is starting to come up in modern society now, it is being looked at under a different lens. And I think that that lens will be, it will streamline the acceptance of psychedelics a lot more than just hippies on the side of the road trying to sell LSD and watermelons and, you know, yelling about the war. I think that freaked people out. But now if it's coming through Imperial College London, it's coming through all of these different institutions, it becomes easier to integrate into social acceptance.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, unfortunately, the us versus them mentality is certainly needed. And it has its place. But I mean, hopefully it is a conversation that gets things started and then people work together to resolve their issues. Because I think that's what you saw in the 60s, right? Is it was just completely us versus them. And then,
yeah,
and an incredibly, like, caustic government situation,
yeah,
with the administration back then, as opposed to now. And yeah, it was just this, okay, well, you're against us, we're against you, and you do drugs, so now they're illegal. And not to mention so that's just like the people that had the means and the privilege to just like take off of work and get in a van and go protest, and like some of the like horrifying things that happened in communities of the Black communities and things of that nature, with the injection of these compounds and the drugs into the community, into this, it's just like terrifying to read
Oh
all that
yeah.
shit.
Oh yeah. Are you a fan of meditation? Do you practice it at all or?
So not as much as ironically as I had before I moved here, because that's not what I study. So,
Yeah, well, you don't want to
but
bringing your work home with you, right?
I think that's part of it. Yeah, I think that's part of it. And just to not be overzealous, right? Because like it's like I've had some very positive, helpful, and profound experiences meditating, and I am honestly pretty new to that whole thing. It's only been a few years that I've been practicing, and right now I don't practice near as much as I would like to,
Yeah, me too.
but I do. I am into it, and one of the threads that we have throughout our research at UCSD, which is why I was so excited to come here, is the meditation thread. So that'll be something that carries through everything that we're going to start to look at, like the effects of psilocybin on the brain and cannabis, and to try to use meditation to see if it's going to be supplementary to predicting positive outcomes and health.
Yeah, see, it seems to me that levels of meditation wherein a change of perception is induced, often referred to as like transcendental meditations, things like that. It's a mode of meditating that looks like it could be comparable to psychedelic experiences. And in my opinion, I think that it could be a case of hacking into your own biochemistry and perturbing an increased synthesis and secretion of DMT or maybe something else into your system, which is what could be contributing to these altered states of consciousness through meditation. I mean, where do you sit on this? Because, a lot of meditation practitioners will say that psychedelics are kind of like an artificial way of achieving enlightenment or something like that. But you should be doing it naturally. But do you think that the natural way of meditating could actually be just you kind of utilizing your own biochemistry in different ways?
We're extremely interested in that here. There's not a whole lot of research on that,
Yeah.
and we're going to start looking at neurochemical changes soon. And yeah, I mean, so we have what we have. Well, I wasn't in the lab yet, but what Fadl, who is my mentor, Fadl Zeidan, has shown in the past is that meditation will relieve pain. So, like experimentally induced pain, meaning we have this thermal probe that we put on people's leg, and it heats up their skin to upwards of like 49 degrees Celsius. So it's like an experience that we say this may or may not feel like pain to you. It doesn't burn their skin, but it's
Yeah.
clearly heating it up to the point where a lot of people feel it's painful. And meditating during that will relieve that pain. But what's mo most interesting to me is when you administer naloxone, which is opioid antagonist, that you still get that effect. So it's not being mediated by opioids. So we're repeating that study in people that actually have chronic pain. So people that have chronic low back pain, and seeing if it translates, if it's not, because the other study was in people that didn't have chronic pain. It was just in that respect, healthy individuals. So we're interested in that. Like, what are the biomolecules and the brain changes, because that's one of the biggest things we do here is look at fMRI changes in the brain during
Right.
meditation and during chronic pain, and soon psilocybin and cannabis. So yeah, we're kind of interested in the whole thing, the whole spectrum, and our lab definitely takes the psychology and the subjective experience into account too. We're very interested in that as well. But yeah, so the biomarker thing, I think, is what I want to make a big part of my career moving forward. And part of that is going to be in terms of DMT. Like, is there a way to reliably analyze DMT in humans? And so far, not really. You can look in blood, you can look in urine, and there are groups that are starting to develop the the sensitivity with things like HPLC in Europe, that I believe they're in Europe, that they're able to get it down to a level that is similar to what we saw in the rat brain,
Right.
to a sensitivity like that. So it may be possible to look for circadian things in the blood, because like if levels are, we know that like serotonin and melatonin sort of reliably change during the sleep-wake cycle. So you may be able to look at things like DMT from that perspective too. And then, yeah, a big emphasis, some of the pilot work we've been doing is try to develop ways to endogenously or to in the living human brain to identify if it's possible to get a trace on DMT and things like serotonin with a non-invasive method. So.
Going back to the research paper real quick, you discovered that there were very high expressions of DMT biosynthetic genes in the area where cerebral spinal fluid's made, which is produced in order to supply nervous system tissue with nutrients, protect the brain from trauma, and carry away metabolic waste. Now, keeping within the context of meditation, are you familiar with a method of meditation known as Kundalini? Right, so Kundalini's been traditionally described through symbology as a snake that lays coiled at the base of the spine, and that through certain meditative practices, you can uncoil the snake, which will then travel up and down the spine and cause what is known as a Kundalini awakening or some form of process like this, which can be related to very powerful sensory stimulation, altered states of consciousness. And this is also physiologically interpreted as energy or electricity coursing up and down the spine of the meditator. Do you think that practices like this could be perhaps perturbing an increased concentration of DMT specifically within the cerebral spinal fluid?
I think it's worth trying to figure that out. Absolutely. I think it's reasonable. I mean, there's a lot of work. I get that question all the time, and there's a lot of work that needs to be laid down before we can even attempt to answer that in humans. Yeah, hence some of the stuff that we've been doing. Like I said, some of the pilot work that we have ongoing now, trying to develop a non-invasive way to image DMT in the living brain. So yeah, it's been moving kind of slow because we just don't have the funding we would like, and also the time, right? Like time and academia is the biggest hurdle, honestly, more so than anything else. But yeah, I mean, once there's a way to reliably get a trace, a fluctuation. So like once we can show a technique that is able to say, hey, even in something as simple as like we measured blood throughout the course of waking and sleeping, and we saw this fluctuation in DMT. And we actually tried to do that in the 2019 study in the rats, because the pineal gland produces this really nice circadian phase for, like I was saying earlier, like serotonin and melatonin. And you get this like spike in serotonin that then drops off into the dark cycle, and then melatonin slowly comes up. So we were interested in seeing like what happened with DMT, and our resolution was, like I said, about every 15 to 30 minutes we would sample. And when you do that with serotonin and melatonin, you get these really nice curves. But the DMT didn't really track very well. It was just kind of up, like all over the place. And people are interested in things like DMT. Is it possible that it's involved in like REM sleep, which or dreaming, which I think is a very interesting question as well. And unfortunately, REM sleep in a rat is like maybe a minute or two. So even though we were getting what was clearly bouts of REM sleep during the experiments, that we just weren't able to reliably link the DMT concentrations to that time point because of our resolution. But yeah, interesting questions that hopefully in my lifetime we can start to understand. But I mean, it's really once you have a reliable way, even if it's sort of a roundabout way with something like PET scanning or whatnot, or even in the blood, if you have a reliable assay, once you have that established, you can start to get at those questions a little bit with science.
Can I ask what your opinion is on the idea of non-locality with consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. Yeah, it's I don't know. I mean, I It's a really difficult question, right? Because no one knows first, right? But so it's like just my opinion, man.
Oh,
But
just speculate away. We know that. Don't worry.
Not that I'm worried, but it's just, I don't know. I mean, like the question is basically for me, like when the brain stops, does experience stop?
Exactly, the receiver versus the generator discussion.
Right. And then, you know, you have things like anesthetics that it's just like, okay, start counting back for, oh, you're done. Surgery's over. You know, and it's like, oh, okay. So I don't know. I mean, I hope not. I hope that's not the case. Right. I don't know, man. I mean, it's a tough one. And you know, you have these really powerful experiences on psychedelics that seem to indicate that the brain is not necessary, but then in reality, the whole experience, you know, your brain's still alive and oxygenated and blood still flowing through it. So, I mean, I don't know, are those experiences just the nature of certain brain areas, just like, you know, the whole like localized versus non-local in terms of how the brain changes when you are on a psychedelic, in terms of like larger systems that never really communicate are now opening up, and it's like breaking down the in-between barriers. So is that all it is, right? Is it just the fact that, well, now your visual cortex is talking to your right homunculus. Is it just a fact that like things are being like rerouted like that? I don't know.
Yeah, it's something that fascinates me, and like I dabble in all sorts of different things. I'm just like a layman for different types of subjects, and so I'm also really interested in, you know, quantum mechanics and computation and models for consciousness within that, like the kind of idea of holographic universes and all this crazy shit. And I think that there is a potential for, because we don't know where consciousness really comes from yet. We don't know, and I think there's a potential for it to still be a field phenomenon, and that we might be in some way a type of kind of like a biological quantum computer that can receive and then kind of as a waveguide propagate consciousness through it in certain ways, and we kind of render it down, and we're like crystallized forms of like nodes on a network, almost like a computer network, and we're just little nodes receiving information through a very complex circuit, and the circuit is our neural chemistry, our neural matrix in our body. And I know we're not there yet, but that's still something where I tend to lean towards that maybe being a possibility over the idea of it simply being highly complex generated phenomena from the brain.
I think that's it's a realistic model. I mean, one thing that we do know about anything is that it's all just information, right?
Like,
it's really just all information. However, whether it's wrapped into, you know, chromosomes, or, you know, or if it's ones and zeros in an electrical signal, like it's all information. So how is that information generated, received? Like, yeah, I think with the where computer science is right now and where it's going, I think that those analogies, I mean, they've already started to blur, right? Just with like AI and just like automated cars with vision, and, you know, how much of that is based on how the brain does work, and how much of it is it's complete different thing. And even the overlap and with how psychedelics work, and how some of those neural networks are trained, there's a lot that, I mean, it seems like it's like philosophical, but I think that it's like rooted in the math a little bit. From my vantage.
Yeah, I agree. I think that a lot of this phenomenology that we look at with consciousness is most likely physics that hasn't been understood yet, or you know, neuroscience that hasn't been understood yet, and we're getting closer towards it. And I think that psychedelics definitely could be seen as a catalyst for entering into that kind of sector of research and interest. Before we wrap up here, mate, I'd love to ask you if you've got any thoughts on this integration that seems to be occurring between artificial intelligence and the human body. I mean, you've got Neuralink with Elon Musk, and you've got other endeavors where they're looking at, you know, embedding artificial circuitry into our neurological makeup. And it, as a species, we are a technological, you know, feverishly technological. And so it would seem to me that it is probably an inevitable situation where we're going to have this kind of convergence with technology, more so than we have already with, you know, wearing smartwatches and stuff. When it becomes embedded within our actual system, what are your thoughts on this? Are you optimistic about that? Do you think we're going to be in the rise of the Terminator Skynet apocalypse? Where do you sit?
Yeah, I think it all boils down to ethics.
Right, right.
With where that's headed, you can envision equally as many amazing discoveries and things that help the humanity, and things equally as catastrophic and conniving and shitty and unethical. So I really think it just boils down to who's leading the charge and how ethical they keep things. And I think, as like anything else, humans are just sort of, I guess I'm being cynical, but I think you'll see both, right? And hopefully enough good will prevail, as it has up till this point, right? We're still here.
Yeah. Well, maybe if we get enough psychedelics into people, then they'll start changing their minds about how to use technology and how to, you know, change the way we view territory and barriers and divisions. But we'll probably need quite a lot of it, perhaps in the water system or something. Anyway, dude, look, it's been a real pleasure to have you on. I think you've done amazing work within a field of modern science that appears to me, at least, to be, although just starting to come up in importance, I think it's at the forefront of radical changes to the status quo. And I think personally, we are at the edge of a fundamental transition in perspectives, and this comes from many arenas. You know, like I said, I'm also interested in quantum physics and computation. I think exotic propulsion and energy systems are going to see a radical transformation as well over the next couple of decades. And I sense this transition is on the horizon, especially within psychedelic research. And so I appreciate the work that you've done, and just want to say thank you for joining me to have a discussion about it.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate the kind words.